This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 24 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Mm.
So picture this. It's 2008.
Oh, boy.
Right. A single financial product, basically credit default swaps, nearly brings the entire global economy to its knees.
Yeah, it was bad.
And essentially this happened because people were trading massive amounts of risk in the dark without holding, you know, enough collateral to back it up.
Exactly.
So when the music stopped, the money just wasn't there. Today, we are looking at the rule book that was built and really rebuilt to ensure that never happens again. We are diving deep into the financial responsibility and funding section of the Series 24 exam. And let me be clear up front, this is not about memorizing flashcards.
No, it absolutely can't be. I mean, if you try to just memorize these SEC and FINRA rules by rote, the exam will crush you. The regulators who write these questions are testing whether you, as a principal, actually understand the underlying mechanics of a broker-dealer. They want to know if you understand the why.
Yeah, the logic behind it.
Exactly. Because if you understand why a rule exists to protect the financial system, well, you can logic your way out of almost any convoluted trick question they throw at you.
Exactly. So we are ditching the dry textbook definitions today. To make these concepts actually stick in your brain, we are going to follow a consistent cast of characters through this whole regulatory maze. And I want you to picture them right now.
Okay, let's hear it.
First, we have Broker Ben. Ben runs a small introducing broker-dealer. He's a charismatic guy. He loves his clients, but he is honestly terrible at accounting and tends to view compliance deadlines as, you know, polite suggestions.
Which is a pretty terrifying combination for a principal in this industry.
Terrifying. Next, we have Clearing Chloe. She runs a massive carrying and clearing firm. Chloe is basically the responsible adult in the room.
Right. She's the one with the vaults.
Yeah, exactly. The vaults, the infrastructure, and the direct lines to the depositories. She actually holds the assets, and she often has to clean up Ben's messes.
And because she holds the actual assets, she's the one with the giant regulatory target on her back. I mean, the SEC watches her every move.
For sure. Then we have Careless Carl. Carl is a retail day trading customer. He loves leverage. He loves taking massive risks on margin, and he treats settlement deadlines like they're totally optional.
Sounds about right.
And finally, Cautious Kathy. Mm-hmm. She's a very wealthy retail client who wants to know exactly where every single penny of her life savings is at all times.
I like Kathy.
So keeping Ben, Chloe, Carl, and Kathy in mind, let's start at the very foundation. Before Broker Ben can even think about taking Cautious Kathy's money and opening an account for her, he has to prove to the government that he is legally and financially allowed to exist as a firm.
Right.
That brings us to the net capital rule.
Yeah, and the net capital rule is fundamentally built around a very morbid, you know, worst case scenario. It asks one basic question. If Broker Ben's firm suffered a catastrophic failure and had to shut its doors tomorrow, does he have enough highly liquid assets on hand to instantly pay off all his customers, settle with his counterparties, and close up shop without causing a systemic contagion?
Okay, let me push back on that a bit, because net worth in the real world is very different from net capital in the regulatory world.
Oh, absolutely.
So let's say Broker Ben leases this gorgeous downtown office. He's got $1 million in solid mahogany desks, expensive abstract art on the walls, and he just prepaid his rent for an entire year. On paper, his business is flush with assets. So he's well capitalized, right?
Right. From an accounting perspective, sure. From an SEC regulatory perspective, he might be functionally insolvent.
Right, really?
Yeah, because what's crucial to understand here is that the SEC does not care about his mahogany desks.
Right.
Under the net capital rule, those are classified as non-allowable assets. Furniture, fixtures, goodwill, unsecured receivables, prepaid expenses, they're entirely worthless to the SEC, and they're subtracted in full from the firm's net worth.
Because you can't pay a customer with a desk.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if Ben goes bankrupt on a random Tuesday, he cannot instantly liquidate a desk or his prepaid rent to pay back Cautious Kathy's cash balance.
Right. That makes sense.
The regulators only care about cash and easily liquidated securities. And it goes even further. Even those liquid securities get hit with haircuts.
Haircuts.
Yeah, which are basically percentage deductions based on their market volatility risk.
Oh, I see.
So if Ben holds a volatile tech stock, the SEC might only let him count 85% of its value toward his net capital, just in case the market drops while he's trying to sell it.
So it is a strict liquid asset floor for winding down a dead firm. You strip out all the fluff. So what are the actual minimum dollar amounts we are talking about here? Like, how much cash equivalent does clearing Chloe need versus broker Ben?
Well, because Chloe runs a carrying firm, meaning she actually holds customer funds and securities in her vaults and bank accounts, her baseline minimum requirement is $250,000. Broker Ben, who runs an introducing firm that just routes trades to Chloe, well, he has a minimum of $50,000, assuming he routinely receives customer funds to forward along.
And I want to flag a massive trap here for anyone listening. This is where the exam tries to get you. You might be thinking, wait a minute, isn't there a $5,000 minimum for introducing brokers?
There is, but it is an incredibly narrow exception. The $5,000 minimum is only for a pure introducing firm that never, ever receives customer funds or securities, period.
Ah.
If Broker Ben touches a physical check from Cautious Kathy, even if he just holds it on his desk for 5 minutes before mailing it to Clearing Chloe, he is instantly reclassified as a $50,000 firm. The mere act of receiving the funds triggers the higher risk profile.
That makes sense. The moment you touch the money, the risk of you losing or stealing it goes up, so the capital requirement goes up.
Exactly.
But let's say Ben is short on cash because he spent all his money on those useless mahogany desks. He needs to raise capital fast, but he refuses to give up equity in his firm. Can he just go down to a local bank and get a business loan?
He can, but a standard bank loan actually hurts his net capital because it's a liability that he has to pay back immediately.
Oh, right.
So if he wants borrowed money to count as regulatory net capital, it must be a subordinated loan agreement.
Okay, break down why subordinated is the magic word there.
Because it legally alters the priority of who gets paid in a bankruptcy. The loan must be formally subordinated to all general creditors.
So he's at the back of the line.
Exactly. Meaning if Ben's firm dies, the person who lent him that money is standing at the very back of the line, behind Cautious Kathy, behind the counterparties, behind everyone.
Wow.
Because the lender agrees to take that massive risk, the SEC allows Ben to treat that borrowed money as if it were equity capital.
It acts like equity without diluting his ownership. Mm-hmm. But there are strict hoops to jump through, right?
Right.
Strict. The loan term must be for a minimum of 1 year. But the biggest exam trap is the timing.
Oh.
A subordinated loan requires FINRA's written approval before the funds can be counted as net capital.
Okay.
If Ben gets $100,000 wired to his account on Monday, and he adds it to his net capital calculation on Tuesday, but FINRA doesn't stamp the approval paperwork until Friday, well, Ben just committed a net capital violation on Wednesday.
That is a classic regulatory trap for principals, which is exactly why the exam tests so heavily. But obviously, the SEC doesn't just sit back and wait for a firm to go bankrupt to find out they ran out of money. They have a tripwire system.
They do. And it's called the early warning system. Regulators do not want to find out you're failing on the day you actually fail.
Yeah, that'd be bad.
They want a head start to manage the fallout.
Yeah.
So they built a 3-tier alarm system based on percentages of your minimum requirement, 150%, 120%, and 100%.
I want the listener to think about this scenario. Give yourself a beat to run the numbers in your head. Let's look at Clearing Chloe. We know her absolute minimum requirement is $250,000. Let's say her actual net capital drops to $300,000. She's still $50,000 above the legal minimum. So she's fine, right? She just keeps operating as normal.
She absolutely does not. She has already tripped the first wire.
Really?
Yeah. At 150% of the minimum requirement, FINRA's early warning alarm goes off. For Chloe, 150% of $250,000 is $375,000. Because she dropped to $300,000, she must notify FINRA within 24 hours.
And what happens if she stays under that $375,000 mark? Does FINRA just put her on a watch list?
It's much more severe than that. If her capital stays suppressed below 150% for more than 15 consecutive business days, after FINRA has had knowledge of it for 5 days, she gets hit with a business expansion restriction.
Like a quarantine.
Think of it exactly as a regulatory quarantine. She cannot open new branch offices. She cannot hire new registered reps. She cannot launch new product lines.
Wow.
The regulator's effectively saying, you can't even fund your current operations safely. You're not allowed to grow. And one vital caveat for the exam, this 150% trigger, is specifically for carrying and clearing firms like Chloe. It does not apply to introducing firms like Ben.
Okay, so Chloe is quarantined, but she keeps losing money. She drops further and hits 300,000 250,000 times 1.2 is 300,000. So she hits 300,000 exactly. That is 120% of her minimum.
That is the SEC's early warning trigger. At 120%, the situation is dire. She must send a formal 24-hour notice to both the SEC and her designated examining authority, which is usually FINRA. This is the federal government officially putting you on death watch.
And then the final step, the cliff. She drops below 250,000 on 100%.
At that point, the 24-hour grace period evaporates. It is a same-day notice.
Same day.
The exact day she realizes her capital is deficient, she must notify the SEC and FINRA, and she must immediately cease conducting any securities business. She cannot execute a single trade until she injects more capital into the firm.
So the latter is, 150% is the FINRA 24-hour notice for clearing firms. 120% is the SEC 24-hour notice for everyone. And under 100% is SEC same-day notice and instant shutdown.
You got it.
But how do the regulators actually monitor this? I mean, Ben and Chloe aren't just logging into a portal every morning and typing in their bank balances.
No, they prove their math through focus reports. This is the continuous monitoring infrastructure of the financial system.
Okay.
Because Clearing Chloe carries customer assets and poses a systemic risk, she has to file her focus part I every single month. And her deadline is within 10 business days after month end.
And broker Ben, he's smaller, less risk.
Ben files focus was part IA, and he only has to file it quarterly. But his deadline is incredibly specific, within 17 business days after quarter end.
Which brings up a great question. Why 17 business days? That is basically 3.5 calendar weeks. Why not 15 or 20?
It's a purely operational calculation. At quarter end, a firm has a massive amount of reconciliation to do with outside banks, clearinghouses, and counterparties.
Right.
The SEC determined that 10 days wasn't enough time to get all the statements back and reconcile the trades, but 20 days was too long to let potential capital deficiencies hide in the shadows. 17 business days is the operational sweet spot.
That makes total sense when you look at it mechanically. Write that 17 down. The exam loves it. And then to round out the year, both Ben and Chloe have to file an annual audited report, which is part 3 of the FOCIS report.
Yes.
And the timeline shifts here. It is due within 60 calendar days after their fiscal year end. Notice the subtle shift regulators do there from business days to calendar days. Okay, so Ben and Chloe have proven they are financially solvent. They exist. But if I'm cautious, Kathy, I'm thinking, great, the firm has its own money. But what is stopping them from commingling my life savings with their operating account to pay for their expenses?
Right, a valid concern.
Which brings us to the customer protection rule and the relationship between Ben and Chloe.
Right, because cautious Kathy might have her relationship with broker Ben, but her actual assets are sitting with clearing Chloe.
Yeah.
That architecture is governed by a formal carrying agreement. And this is not a casual handshake deal. The agreement must be written, and it must be submitted to FINRA in advance for approval.
Let's talk about how they divide up the labor. They have to allocate who sends the monthly statements, who handles order routing, who handles customer complaints. But there is one golden rule about who actually holds the cash in stock.
Yes. The safeguarding of funds and securities must be allocated to clearing Chloe.
It has to be her.
It cannot be flipped back to broker Ben. FINRA will reject any agreement that attempts to let Ben safeguard the assets. Because Ben only has $50,000 in net capital, he doesn't have the financial buffer or the vault infrastructure to safely hold customer property.
And before Chloe can even start acting as the clearing firm for Ben's clients, she has to give FINRA a heads up.
She has to give FINRA 10 business days advance gating notice, and she must specifically include Ben's CRD number, his regulatory ID, in that notice.
Got it.
It's a hard operational gate to ensure FINRA knows exactly whose assets are migrating into Chloe's ecosystem.
Okay, so Chloe now officially holds Kathy's money in stock. How does the SEC ensure Chloe keeps it safe? This is the customer protection rule, which is basically built on two pillars. Pillar one is securities. Pillar two is cash.
Right.
Let's unpack pillar one. The rule says the firm must have possession or control of customer securities. That means they are locked up at a depository like DTCC or physically in a bank vault. But it doesn't apply to all securities, right?
Correct. It applies to all fully paid securities and all excess margin securities.
Let's do a real world scenario to understand excess margin. Cautious Kathy wants to buy $100,000 worth of stock. She puts down $50,000 in cash and takes a $50,000 margin loan from Chloe to cover the rest.
Okay.
So Kathy owes Chloe $50,000. How much of that $100,000 in stock is considered excess margin that Chloe must lock up in a vault and cannot touch? Think about the math for a second, listeners.
So the mechanism the SEC uses here is the 140% rule.
Right.
And the trick is that you apply the 140% to the debit balance, the loan amount, not the total market value of the stock.
So Kathy owes a $50,000 debit balance.
Right. You take 140% of that $50,000, which gives you $70,000.
Okay. Let's explain the why behind that $70,000. The SEC is saying Chloe is allowed to take $70,000 of Kathy's stock and use it as collateral for her own business operations, like pledging it to a bank to fund the loan she gave Kathy. But why 140%? Why not just let Chloe use $50,000 stock to back the $50,000 loan?
Because of market volatility.
Yeah.
I mean, if Chloe only pledged $50,000 of stock and the market suddenly dropped 10%, her collateral would be worth
$45,000. Oh.
The bank would instantly issue a margin call, Chloe would have to scramble for cash, and it could trigger a liquidity crisis.
Yeah.
By allowing Chloe to use 140% of the loan value, the SEC builds in a 40% buffer against intraday flash crashes.
Brilliant. But Kathy owns $100,000 in stock, so if Chloe uses $70,000 as collateral, that leaves a remaining $30,000.
Exactly. That $30,000 is the excess margin. Yeah. Because it exceeds the 140% buffer, that $30,000 must be rigorously segregated under strict possession or control. Chloe cannot pledge it. She cannot lend it out. It is untouchable.
So that's pillar one, protecting the securities. What about pillar two, the cash? How do we protect uninvested money?
Pillar two revolves around the special reserve bank account. This is driven by a complex weekly calculation called the reserve formula. Essentially, Chloe totals up all the money she owes her customers. These are her credit balances. Then she totals up all the money her customers owe her. These are the margin debit balances.
I like to think of this as a firm's waterline. If the tide of customer credits comes rushing in and exceeds the debits, the firm is basically holding too much of the customer's cash relative to the loans they've made.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. If the credits exceed the debits, Chloe must sandbag that waterline. She must deposit that exact dollar difference into a special reserve bank account that is maintained for the exclusive benefit of customers.
Exclusive benefit.
Yes. If Chloe's firm goes bankrupt, her general creditors cannot touch a single cent in that reserve account.
And how often is she doing this math? It sounds exhausting.
For standard firms, it's computed weekly. She takes a snapshot at the close of business on Friday, crunches the numbers over the weekend, and if she has a shortfall, she must deposit the required cash into the bank by Tuesday morning at 10 a.m.
But what if you are a mega firm? What if you are holding billions in customer cash?
Then the weekly snapshot isn't safe enough. There is a daily exception. If Chloe's firm has average total credits hitting $500 million or more, the SEC forces her to compute this reserve formula every single business day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it requires massive back office infrastructure, but it prevents $500 million of customer cash from drifting unprotected for a whole week.
Speaking of customer cash drifting, let's talk about cautious Kathy's free credit balances. Let's say Kathy sells a bond and she has $20,000 in cash just sitting in her brokerage account uninvested. She logs into her app, sees the $20,000 balance, and naturally assumes it is sitting in a virtual vault with her name on it. But it's not, is it?
It is absolutely not in a vault. Free credit balances are considered general liabilities of the broker dealer.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Chloe's firm can actually use Kathy's $20,000 to fund its own business operations, like funding Careless Carl's margin loans.
Hold on, if I'm Kathy, I am furious. You're telling me my conservative, uninvested cash is being secretly used to fund Carl's reckless day trading. How is that legally permissible?
It's permissible because that $20,000 flows directly into the reserve formula we just talked about.
Oh, right.
As long as the aggregate formula is balanced and the net difference across the entire firm is safely locked in the special reserve bank account, the firm is allowed to use the float to maintain market liquidity. However, because customers would understandably be shocked to learn this, the SEC mandates transparency.
I have to warn her.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The firm must send Kathy a written disclosure at least quarterly. It must explicitly state that her funds are not segregated, that they may be used in the firm's business, and most importantly, that they are payable to her on demand.
Okay, so that perfectly segues into how firms play with the collateral they are allowed to use. Let's talk about hypothecation and lending.
Let's do it.
Going back to our earlier math, Chloe has $70,000 of Kathy's stock that she is legally allowed to use. She decides to take that stock to a commercial bank and pledge it as collateral for a bank loan to fund her operations. This act of pledging is called hypothecation.
Correct. And the SEC has three incredibly strict rules here to prevent the misappropriation of customer property during that pledge.
Okay, what's first?
First, you cannot commingle different customers' securities under the same bank lien unless you have their written consent to do so.
Which, to be fair, is buried in the fine print of every standard margin agreement anyway.
True. But the second rule is the critical one. You cannot commingle customer securities with the firm's own proprietary securities under any pledge.
Let me push this to the extreme. Let's say Cautious Kathy and Clearing Chloe are best friends outside of work. Kathy writes a notarized letter in blood saying, Chloe, I completely understand the risks and I legally consent to you mixing my Apple stock with your firm's Apple stock at the bank to get a better loan rate. Does that override the rule?
It does not matter at all.
No.
The SEC enforces an absolute ban on firm-to-customer commingling. Customer consent is irrelevant.
Why are they so stubborn about it?
Because of bankruptcy law.
Yeah.
If Chloe's firm blows up and a commercial bank tries to seize a mixed pool of collateral that contains both firm assets and customer assets, it creates an absolute nightmare trying to untangle who owns what.
Oh, that makes sense.
The SEC draws a hard line to ensure customer property is always legal and distinct and protected from the firm's creditors.
And the third hypothecation rule is a ceiling on how much you can pledge.
Yes. The total pledge to the bank cannot exceed the aggregate indebtedness of all the pledged customers. It is a pooled ceiling.
Okay.
If Carl and Kathy owe a combined $120,000 in margin debt, Chloe cannot pledge more than $120,000 of their collective stock to the bank.
Right.
And further, Chloe must give the bank a written pledge notice. She has to officially inform the bank that these securities are customer property, meaning the bank cannot assert any claim over them that supersedes the customer's rights.
Okay, so hypothecation is pledging to a bank for a loan. But what if a hedge fund wants to short a stock and Chloe wants to lend them Kathy's shares for a fee?
This is a massive exam trap because there are two entirely different regulatory frameworks depending on whether the customer has a margin loan or not.
Okay.
If careless Carl is trading on margin, lending his stock is easy. When he opened the margin account, he signed a margin agreement. That single signature gives the firm the blanket right to lend his margin securities to short sellers.
But Cautious Kathy doesn't have a margin loan. She owns 1,000 shares of Apple outright, fully paid. But she wants to earn some extra yield, so she asks Chloe to lend them out.
That falls under a fully paid lending program. And the regulatory bar is astronomically high because the systemic risk is higher. It requires four strict things.
All right, hit me.
One, the firm must provide FINRA with a 30-day advance written notice before initiating the program. Two, the firm must conduct a rigorous appropriateness review for Kathy to ensure she actually understands what she is doing. Three, the firm must provide Kathy with collateral equal to 100% of the market value of the borrowed stock, and they must mark that collateral to market every single day.
Then what's the fourth requirement? Because this is the one that should terrify retail investors.
The fourth requirement is a blunt written disclosure warning Kathy that SIPA and SIPC may not protect those loan securities.
Wow.
If Chloe's firm goes bankrupt while Kathy's Apple stock is out on loan to a short seller, SIPC coverage does not apply. Kathy is entirely reliant on the collateral the firm posted. She steps outside the federal safety net, and she must sign off that she understands that gap.
That is a profound difference. Margin lending takes one signature. Fully paid lending requires 30 days notice, appropriateness reviews, daily collateral adjustments, and a waiver of SIPC protection. Speaking of margin, let's pivot to the leverage engine itself. Reg T, FINRA, maintenance margin, and extensions. We've been talking about loans conceptually, but who actually sets the mathematical rules for how much careless Carl can borrow to buy his speculative tech stocks? Is it the Federal Reserve or is it FINRA Menti?
It's actually both.
Hmm.
But they govern two completely different moments in the timeline of a trade. The Federal Reserve Board controls Regulation T. Reg T is the rule for initial margin.
Initial. Okay.
It dictates the minimum amount Carl must deposit at the exact moment he buys the stock. Under current Reg T, he must put up 50% of the purchase price.
Think of Reg T as the down payment at a car dealership. You need 50% up front just to drive the stock off the lot.
That's right. But once you drive it off the lot, the value of that stock is going to fluctuate every single day.
Yeah.
That's where FINRA takes over. FINRA sets the maintenance margin. This is the ongoing equity you must maintain in the account to keep the loan open. FINRA requires Carl to maintain at least 25% equity for long positions. But if Carl is shorting a stock, FINRA requires 30% maintenance equity.
Why the discrepancy? Why does FINRA demand a higher buffer for short selling?
Because the risk profiles are fundamentally different. I mean, if Carl buys a stock long, the absolute worst thing that can happen is the company goes bankrupt and the stock goes to zero. His maximum loss is 100%.
Right.
But if Carl shorts a stock and that company suddenly announces a cure for cancer, the stock could gap up 500% in minutes. A short position has theoretically infinite risk. FINRA demands a 30% buffer to protect the firm from a sudden short squeeze.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, let's test the listeners again with a timeline question. Careless Carl decides he is done with margin. He just wants to buy a stock in a standard cash account. But being Carl, he forgets to wire the money.
Of course he does.
Right. Under Reg T, the payment date is S plus 2. That's settlement date plus 2 business days. Now, we currently live in a T plus 1 settlement world. Trade date plus 1 day for settlement. So S plus 2 means Carl must pay by T plus 3. If he buys on Monday, he must pay by Thursday. So direct question, listeners. If Carl blows past that Thursday deadline and doesn't pay, what is the exact punishment levied against his account? Think about it.
The penalty is a 90-day cash account freeze. For the next 90 days, Carl cannot buy a single security unless the full cash amount is already sitting settled in his account before the order is placed. He loses all grace periods.
And what if he tries to pull a fast one? What if he buys a stock on Monday, doesn't pay for it, but then sells that same stock on Wednesday and tries to use the sale proceeds to cover his initial purchase?
Oh, that is a severe violation known as free riding.
Free riding.
You are essentially using the market's money to finance your own trades without putting up any capital. Free riding is strictly prohibited and instantly triggers that same 90-day freeze.
But wait, Broker Ben is a nice guy. He wants to save Carl from the freeze. Can Ben just wave a wand and grant Carl an extension?
Ben can't wave a wand, but he can formally request a margin extension from FINRA, or his clearing firm. But here's the critical exam concept. Extensions are not automatic, and they are not a right.
Right.
FINRA manually reviews them. They look at Carl's history, they look at Ben's good faith efforts to collect the debt, and they evaluate market conditions.
And if Ben is asking for extensions for Carl every other week,
FINRA will view that as a pattern of inadequate funding. Repeated extension requests are a massive red flag. Regulators will interpret it as Ben failing to enforce credit rules, which will bring audits and severe scrutiny down on the firm.
Okay, let's shift gears to day trading. If you studied for a financial exam 5 or 10 years ago, you probably spent hours memorizing the pattern day trader rule, the PDT rule. You had to memorize the $25,000 minimum equity and the exact definition of 4 day trades in 5 rolling business days. Well, listen closely, forget it all. PDT is dead. It was repealed. Do not pick it as an answer on the Series 24.
That is a vital update. The SEC and FINRA realized that counting the number of trades a retail client makes over 5 days was an arbitrary and clunky way to measure risk.
Totally.
So they completely ripped out the pattern day trader regime and replaced it with the intraday margin deficit framework.
Explain how the new framework operates. Why is it better?
It focuses entirely on real-time financial exposure. Regulators no longer care if Carl executes 4 trades or 40 trades. They only care if his risk exceeds his equity at any point during the trading day. If Carl's leveraged day trading creates an intraday margin deficit, he has to cure it.
What if it's just a tiny blip, like he's over by 50 bucks?
There is a de minimis carve-out to prevent nuisance violations.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, if the deficit is less than 5% of his total equity, or under $1,000, whichever is less, the firm can ignore it.
Okay.
But if it's a real deficit, he must meet a margin call promptly. If Carl fails to cure that intraday margin deficit by the close of the 5th business day, he gets slapped with a 90-day restriction where he cannot create any new short positions or debit balances. It is a much more surgical tool for managing risk.
Okay, between Reg T, maintenance, and intraday deficits, Carl is swimming in leverage rules. Does the firm actually have to explain this math to him, or is it just buried in terms of service?
The margin disclosure rules are very strict. When Carl opens the account, Ben's firm must hand him a written credit terms disclosure. It has to clearly state the annual interest rate, the exact method used to calculate it, and explain the daily debit balance method.
Okay, so they spell it out.
Yes. Furthermore, he must receive quarterly statements detailing the accrued interest. And if the firm decides to change how they calculate that interest, they are legally required to give him advance written notice before the change takes effect, so he has the opportunity to close his loans or move his account.
So that's how we handle standard equity margin. But let's zoom out to the macroeconomic picture. What about the really exotic, toxic stuff? Let's go back to credit default swaps, which we mentioned at the very beginning of the deep dive.
Right. Credit default swaps act essentially like insurance policies against a bond defaulting, but structurally they are derivatives. In 2008, companies like AIG sold billions of dollars in uncleared CDS protection to banks without posting adequate margin collateral.
Yeah, we know how that ended.
Right. When the housing market collapsed and those bonds defaulted, AIG didn't have the cash to pay out the insurance claims, and it nearly collapsed the global financial system. So post-2008, NIRO enacted incredibly strict CDS margin rules.
How do those rules function today?
The core distinction you need to know is whether the CDS is cleared or uncleared. If it's a cleared CDS, meaning the trade goes through a central clearinghouse that acts as the ultimate guarantor, the fine-ary margin requirement is elegantly simple.
Oh, yeah.
The requirement is just whatever the clearinghouse dictates. The firm doesn't have to calculate an extra fine-ary layer on top.
But what if it's uncleared? Two institutions just trading a bespoke swap in the dark.
That is where the heavy regulation lives. For uncleared swaps, the firm must compute its own margin using fine-ary's two-part method. First, they must collect initial margin, which is designed to cover potential future exposure based on volatility models.
Okay.
Plus, they must collect variation margin, which covers the current mark-to-market losses calculated daily. You cannot pick one or the other. You must collect both to prevent another EIG scenario.
Okay, let's take a breath. We just covered a massive amount of funding and leverage mechanics. Let's move to the back office operations, reporting and restrictions. While Carl is out there generating intraday deficits, what is Clearing Chloe's back office actually doing to process these trades?
They are managing clearance and settlement. And here is a crucial conceptual distinction for the exam. Trade reporting and trade clearance are two completely separate parallel obligations. They track different things at different speeds.
Let me try an analogy. Trade reporting is like a news reporter at a car crash. Their only job is to scream into a microphone within 10 seconds and tell the world, hey, a transaction just happened here at this price.
That's accurate. If you execute an OTC equity trade, you report it to the ORF. If it's a NASDAQ stock, it goes to the NASDAQ TRF. If it's an NYSE stock, it goes to the FANRA or NYSE TRF. That reporting usually has to happen within 10 seconds of execution.
Right.
But telling the tape a trade happened doesn't actually transfer the stock or the money.
Right. For that, you need the moving company. That's trade clearance.
Exactly. To actually move the assets, the trade data must be submitted to a registered clearing agency, usually the NSCC. The NSCC runs a system called Continuous Net Settlement, or CNS.
CNS, got it.
CNS is a massive daily calculator that nets out all of a firm's buys and sells across millions of trades into one clean net number of shares owed or cash due. And under our current rules, the actual physical settlement of those net numbers happens on T plus one, the next business day.
So 10 seconds for the news reporter at the TRF, T plus one for the moving company at the NSCC. What else is the back office quietly reporting to regulators?
Short interest. Every member firm must report their gross short interest positions twice a month. The snapshot dates are always the 15th of the month and the last business day of the month.
What's the exact deadline for submitting that data?
The report is due by 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the second business day after the reporting settlement date. And here is the nuance. Only settled short positions count toward this report.
Only settled?
Yes. If Careless Carl shorted a stock at 3 p.m. today, and it hasn't settled through the CNS system yet, it does not go on the report.
And just to clarify for the listeners, this twice-a-month reporting is purely a data-gathering exercise, so FINRA can publish short interest statistics. The actual substantive rules for how you legally short a stock, like locate requirements and closeouts, well, those live in SEC Regulation SHO, which is an entirely different deep dive.
Good point.
Now, let's talk about Insight, the clearing firm reporting rule. FINRA had this grand idea that they wanted to ingest all the customer account data across the entire industry into one massive database to hunt for insider trading and market manipulation. So they made a rule that carrying firms like Chloe have to send them massive data dumps of all account information.
Yes. The burden falls squarely on Chloe, not Broker Ben, because Chloe's the one who actually holds the official books and records.
Right.
But here is the bizarre regulatory twist you absolutely need to know for the exam.
Yeah.
FINRA actually stopped collecting this specific Insight data feed in late 2023. They essentially discontinued the technological program.
But the rule wasn't repealed. It's still sitting right there in the rule book.
Precisely. The requirement technically remains codified, even though FINRA isn't currently building the pipes to collect it. So if you see it on the test, You need to know it's a clearing firm obligation, but just recognize in the real world that the data isn't actively flowing under that specific mandate right now.
Got it. Okay, moving on to one of my favorite rules, because the logic behind it is so clean. The new issue credit restriction, also known as the 30-day cooling off period. Let me use an analogy here. Let's say you own a car dealership. You have a brand new, highly anticipated sports car on the lot. A guy walks in and you sell it to him at a massive premium, but you also operate a financing wing and you immediately loan him 100% of the money to buy the car. You are basically using your own capital to artificially prop up the demand and the sales price of your own inventory.
That is exactly the conflict of interest the SEC is targeting in the capital markets. Mm-hmm. If Broker Ben's firm participates in the distribution of an IPO, meaning he is part of the underwriting syndicate or the selling group, he is legally barred from extending margin credit on that specific security for 30 days after the distribution ends.
Because if he could lend his clients money to buy the IPO he is actively trying to sell, he could artificially inflate the price of the stock, creating a false market.
Precisely. The SEC forces Ben to wait 30 days. He has to let the market cool off and allow the stock to find its true, unleveraged price discovery before he can accept those shares as margin collateral.
That makes total sense. Are there any exemptions?
There are only two major exemptions you need to memorize here. First, direct participation programs, or DPPs. These are illiquid alternative investments like real estate limited partnerships. Because there is virtually no secondary trading market for them, there is no secondary price to artificially prop up, so they are exempt from the 30-day rule.
And the second exemption?
Investment company shares, like mutual funds. But the exemption only applies when they are used purely as margin collateral.
Wait, explain that.
If Ben sells a client a mutual fund, he cannot lend the customer money to buy that fund. But if the customer has owned the fund for 30 days, Ben can accept those fund shares as collateral to back a margin loan so the customer can buy something else entirely.
Beautiful distinction. You can use the car as collateral for a loan. You just can't use the loan to buy the car.
Yeah.
Okay, last item in the back office before things go wrong. SOX, internal controls. Sarbanes-Oxley. I know accounting standards can put people to sleep, but what are regulators actually hunting for here?
They're looking at the PCAOB registered independent auditors who evaluate the firm's internal control over financial reporting, or ICFR.
Okay.
The auditors are specifically hunting for one phrase, a material weakness.
Define that in plain English for us.
A material weakness means that the firm's internal accounting controls are so flawed or non-existent that there is a reasonable possibility a massive material misstatement in the firm's financials will occur and will not be prevented or detected on a timely basis. If auditors find a material weakness, it gets flagged. And it is a massive flashing red light to investors and regulators that the firm's numbers cannot be trusted.
Which brings us to the final act, the fail-safes, bonds, stolen certificates, and SIPC. Despite all these early warning letters, 140% margin cushions, and SOX auditors, what happens when things go catastrophically wrong? Let's say one of Broker Ben's employees discovers a loophole and just straight up steals $500,000 from the firm's accounts.
That catastrophic event triggers the fidelity bond.
Yeah.
Every single member firm is required to carry a fidelity bond. It's essentially an insurance policy against employee dishonesty, forgery, embezzlement, and insider theft.
Got it.
But you must remember what it does not cover. It does not cover market losses. If careless Carl loses $1 million betting on bad options, trades, and defaults, the fidelity bond pays absolutely nothing. It is strictly for internal malfeasance.
So how big does this insurance policy have to be? Let's do the math.
The size of the bond scales directly with the firm's net capital requirement. For smaller firms that have a net capital requirement under $250,000, the minimum bond coverage is calculated as the greater of 120% of their net capital requirement, or $100,000.
Okay, let's test that. Broker Ben receives customer funds, so his net capital requirement is $50,000. 120% of his $50,000 requirement is $60,000. So Ben only needs to buy a $60,000 bond, right?
No. Because of the $100,000 floor, the rule says the greater of the two, the greater of $60,000 or $100,000 is $100,000. Therefore, Ben must maintain a $100,000 fidelity bond.
That is exactly how they will trick you on the exam. They will put $60,000 as answer A. Do not fall for the 100K floor trap. Also, the rules state this bond must be per loss. What does that mean mechanically?
It means there is no aggregate annual limit. If Ben has three separate rogue employees who each steal $100,000 in three totally separate, isolated incidents in the same calendar year, the bond covers all three losses fully.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't max out after the first claim. Additionally, the firm is allowed to take a deductible on the policy up to 25% of the coverage amount to lower their monthly premiums. But the SEC is clever.
How so?
Any deductible amount that exceeds 10% of the coverage must be directly subtracted from the firm's net worth when calculating their net capital.
So if you try to be cheap and buy a policy with a massive deductible, the SEC makes you pay for that risk out of your own regulatory capital.
I love that. Okay, what if an employee doesn't steal cash, but steals an actual physical paper stock certificate from the vault?
And then we transition to the lost, stolen, or counterfeit securities rule. You must immediately report the theft to the Securities Information Center, or SIC, using Form X17-F1A. You must also notify the transfer agent who issued the stock, and if criminality is suspected, you must involve the FBI. But the real operational meat of this rule that gets tested is the $10,000 inquiry rule.
Yes, this is a strict operational mandate. If Broker Ben receives any physical stock or bond certificate valued at over $10,000, he must query the SIC database within 5 business days of receiving it to ensure it hasn't been reported stolen.
Okay.
And critically, he must perform this inquiry before he attempts to sell it, route it, or pledge it to a bank.
Let me play devil's advocate. What if Ben knows the customer intimately? It's cautious Kathy. She is worth $50 million. She's been a client for 20 years. She drops off a $15,000 municipal bond certificate. Ben knows she wouldn't steal a certificate. So he skips the SIC database inquiry to save his back office some time, and he deposits it. It turns out the certificate is totally clean. It wasn't stolen. Did Ben break the rule?
Yes, he absolutely committed a violation. Skipping the inquiry is a violation in itself, even if the certificate is perfectly clean and legitimate. Regulatory compliance is not based on how much you trust your wealthy clients. It is based on adherence to the process. The rule is about enforcing the operational step every single time.
Process over trust. Okay, we have reached the ultimate fail-safe. The absolute worst case scenario. The Fidelity bond wasn't enough. The net capital dried up and Broker Ben goes completely bankrupt. The firm dies. Enter SIPC and SIPA.
The Securities Investor Protection Corporation, created by the Securities Investor Protection Act. First, a major misconception to clear up. SIPC is a nonprofit, member-funded corporation. It is not a federal government agency, even though it is created under federal law. When a firm fails, SIPC steps in to replace missing customer cash and securities.
What does SIPC absolutely not cover?
It does not protect against market losses. Mm. If you bought a tech stock and it crashes 90%, SIPC doesn't care. That's market risk. It also does not cover commodities or futures contracts. And, as we discussed in detail earlier, it does not cover fully paid securities that a customer voluntarily loaned out to short sellers.
Let's get into the math, because this is guaranteed to be tested. The magic limits are $500,000 in total coverage, with a $250,000 sublimit specifically for cash. But here's the trick that destroys test takers. That limit does not apply per person. It applies per separate capacity.
Right. I want the listener to really visualize this capacity math. Cautious Kathy has 3 distinct accounts at Ben's firm. Account 1 is an individual account in her name only, holding $600,000 in stock.
Okay.
Account 2 is a joint account with her husband, holding $400,000 in stock. Account 3 is her traditional IRA, holding $300,000 in pure cash. Broker Ben's firm vaporizes and the assets are missing. What is Kathy's total SIPC coverage across those 3 accounts? Give yourself a beat to calculate it.
Okay, let's break down logically. Individual, joint, IRA. Are those considered separate capacities?
Yes. There are 3 legally distinct ownership capacities. Because SIPC wants to encourage investors to use different types of accounts for different life goals, she doesn't just get one $500,000 limit. She gets 3 independent limits.
Right.
Let's look at the individual account with $600K in stock. SIPC covers these maximum $500,000. She becomes a general creditor for the top $100K she lost. Now look at the joint account with $400K in stock. She is fully covered. She gets the entire $400K replaced.
And the IRA. That one has $300,000 in pure cash.
The IRA is a separate capacity, so it theoretically has its own $500K limit. But because it holds cash, it hits the cash sublimit. SIPC only replaces up to $250,000 in missing cash per capacity. So for the IRA, she gets $250,000 and she loses the remaining $50,000.
So in total, SIPC writes checks for $500K for the individual, plus 400K for the joint, plus 250K for the IRA. That is 1.15 million in total coverage across the three capacities. That is how you decode the SIPC math questions. You isolate each account by its legal capacity, apply the overarching 500K limit, and then check to see if the cash sublimit triggers a trap.
Exactly. Don't add all her accounts together into one giant pile. Treat each capacity as an island.
Okay, as we bring this deep dive in for a landing, let's cover a couple of special cases. What if Broker Ben's firm is based in London, but he is a registered FIANR member?
That falls under the foreign member rule. If his firm is based abroad and he has no U.S. reporting office, he has to comply with four specific requirements to maintain membership.
What are they?
He must file all his FOCIS reports in English and in U.S. dollars. He has to legally agree to reimburse FINRA for their travel costs if they have to fly examiners to London to audit him. He must clear his trades through a designated U.S. channel.
Yeah.
And he must maintain an English-speaking liaison.
Okay, fairly straightforward.
But notice the trap here. What is not required by this specific rule? He does not need to appoint a U.S. process agent under this FINRA rule. That is a requirement under a different SEC rule for foreign broker-dealers, so don't mix up the jurisdictions on the exam.
Good catch. And what about exempted securities? If a firm only trades U.S. government treasuries or municipal bonds, do they have to deal with all this?
Government securities have virtually zero credit risk, so firms that deal solely in U.S. government securities are exempt from many of the harshest rules.
Makes sense.
The most testable fact, a firm dealing exclusively in U.S. gov securities is entirely exempt from joining SIPC because the government already backs the assets.
Wow. Okay, it is time for the rapid-fire recap. These are the top five testable takeaways to sear into your brain before you walk into the testing center. Number one, the customer protection segregation limit.
140% of the customer's debit balance. That is the absolute maximum value a customer's stock the firm can use as collateral. Anything above that 140% is classified as excess margin and must be locked up in possession or control.
Number two, the early warning ladder for net capital.
150% triggers a FINRA 24-hour notice for clearing firms. 120% triggers an SEC 24-hour notice for everyone. 100% or below triggers an SEC same-day notice and an immediate halt to business.
Number three, the leverage engine margin rules.
Reg T governs initial margin at 50%. If you fail to pay by S+2, your account gets a 90-day cash freeze. And FINRA governs maintenance margin, requiring 25% equity for long positions and a higher 30% equity for short positions due to infinite risk.
Number four, fully paid securities lending.
A massively high regulatory bar compared to standard margin lending. It requires a 30-day advance notice to FINRA, daily mark-to-market collateral postings, and a written disclosure acknowledging that SIPA does not protect the loaned assets.
Number five, SIPC coverage limits.
Coverage is applied per separate legal capacity, not per person. The limit is $500,000 total per capacity, with the $250,000 cash maximum sitting inside that total.
What a journey. We have gone from Ben's useless mahogany desks all the way to SIPC liquidations. To wrap this up, I want to leave you with a provocative thought that connects the dots we've been talking about today.
Think about that massive risk gap in fully paid lending we discussed.
Exactly. Retail customers absolutely love the extra yield they get from lending out their fully paid stock. It feels like free money. But remember, the moment they sign that agreement, SIPC steps entirely out of the picture. They are no longer under the federal umbrella. They are left relying purely on the daily mark-to-market collateral posted by the borrowing firm.
Which works fine until it doesn't.
Right. But what happens in a flash crash? What if the market drops 30% in 10 minutes? The hedge fund that borrowed the stock defaults, the clearing broker defaults under the strain, and the collateral values lag behind the real-time destruction. With SIPC gone, who really ends up holding the bag? It is a structural vulnerability baked into the system that is just waiting for the exact right stress test to break it open. Something to think about on your walk. Good luck on the Series 24.